Thank you for joining me this evening. Going viral, zombies, viruses, and the end of the world. Having a lighter night tonight as we talk about zombie and monster and outbreak pop culture with our guest, Dahlia Schweitzer. Her new book is out, Going Viral, Zombies, Viruses, and the End of the World. I'm curious, Dahlia, why do you think there are so many movies, TV shows, and books about these viral outbreaks, and what makes them so popular with us?
Well, I think there are a couple different reasons, and I think zombies is one of the things that's really interesting about zombies is that zombies reflect sort of the current social fears and anxieties, right? So the zombies now are tapping into different anxieties than zombies did at the beginning of the 20th century, for instance. And I think one of the reasons they're popular, and this is what we were talking about at the beginning of the show, is that in many ways, it feels like the apocalypse is just around the corner, right? And we have events like the riots in Ferguson, for instance, that serve as really disturbing reminders that this social order that we take for granted could disappear in the blink of an eye, right? And so I think people are aware of that in their subconscious, and so they're intrigued to see what's it going to look like when this social order really does collapse. Right. And a lot of people feel like the government's not going to protect us if something goes wrong. We don't really trust our doctors to protect us if something goes wrong. So we kind of feel like we're on our own. And so I think we want to see these situations play out because we feel like that could happen. And so it becomes both sort of cathartic, but also instructional. I think that's a huge reason. And then I think on a more specific scale, we were talking about Night of the Living Dead at the beginning of the show, and one of the main differences between zombies then and zombies now is that usually in a zombie narrative, you see a mob of zombies, right? Like there's that breathtaking scene in World War Z where all the zombies are coming over the wall, right? And there's just like hundreds of them after you. Right. And I think that also taps into what a lot of people are feeling, and this goes into what we were also talking about with the technology kind of making us more isolated, is I think a lot of people feel like they are just part of a network, you know, that we're part of a mass, and the idea of the individual being able to change things and make an impact feels like this very quaint and idealized notion, right? I mean, you even have people who say, like, I'm not going to vote because one vote won't make a difference, or why should I get involved in politics because everything's rigged? And so I think zombie narratives also speak to that fear of losing identity, losing agency, being part of this mob, not having a voice, not having any sort of individual power, and instead having really powerful networks, corporations, right? And this is what you have in Resident Evil. So I think you have the everyday man who loses agency and control, either because you're a zombie and you lose, you know, your soul, your individuality, whatever. Or if you look at something like The Strain, you're being controlled by someone else, right? And so I think that also sort of speaks to what's going on in this current moment where people feel like they're losing their freedom, they're losing their identity, Well, I mean, look at what's happening in terms of people's careers, right? It's like we used to feel, oh, you're going to get a good job and a good career and you're going to have financial security. And now it's like, who has financial security anymore? You know, you're 45, you get laid off, you can't get another job. So I think all these narratives really speak to these kinds of fears and anxieties, some more literally than others. But I think that's what's really going on in the climate right now.
You've got all of these stories over the last decade, right? It seems right. Every few years we're going to get wiped out. H1N1, swine flu, bird flu, Ebola has made its way to America. We are doomed. Why are we so terrified of these diseases, especially when year after year they don't pan out to do anything more than the flu would have done to wipe us out?
Yes, that's what's ridiculous. And of course, the sensational headlines, you know, where 1.5 million people are predicted to get the flu, that's, you know, on the front page. And then when 51 people get it that is maybe buried, you know, on page 12 somewhere. So I think part of it is just the way the media portrays it, because the media knows you're a lot more likely to pick up a newspaper or click on an article if it says 1.5 million, you know, predicted to die, rather than if it says 50 predicted to get sick, right? I mean, what article are you going to be more likely to read? So part of it is just this sort of genuine need to, like, you know, clickbait, right? I want, you know, you want people to stay tuned and watch the news. You want people to read your article. And then also on a sort of deeper level, you have scientists and doctors who want funding, right? So they're going to deliberately play on your fears, because that's going to get them funding to do this kind of research, right? And diabetes and heart disease aren't really as sensational, right? We're not going to get as worked up over the fact that someone you know has diabetes, right? So that's part of what's going on. And I touch on that in my book, where I talk about how there is this precedent for, you know, people being intentionally manipulated in order to increase funding, right? And so, like, during the Korean War, when all these government budgets were being slashed because they had to divert funding into the war, and they intentionally, Alexander Langmuir intentionally created a disease surveillance department, okay? And the disease surveillance department, all they do is they just look to see, oh, are there three people in Boston and two people in Vermont that have the same weird flu? Right. That's what they do. They look at the reports from the hospitals and they compare in order to see, you know, I mean, that's how they caught HIV eventually. Right. Because they noticed, like, oh, there are these patterns. But they gave it the sexy title of surveillance so they could get funding from the Defense Department, because it sounds like a defense expenditure. So part of it is just funding. Right. And then part of it's Hollywood. You know, what are you going to be more likely to pay money to watch? You're going to watch a movie of someone dying of diabetes, or someone dying of this, like, graphic illness where blood is shooting out of their eyes and everything? I mean, it's sensational. It's fun. And so people have this idea in their head that Ebola is this very visceral, visual thing. And also, I think the other thing that really taps into people's fear is, a lot of times we feel like, oh, well, my behavior is going to prevent me from getting heart disease, right? My behavior is going to prevent me from getting diabetes. My behavior is going to prevent me from getting an STD or whatever. And what terrifies people about things like Ebola is this notion, oh, my God, I could be a good person and I can still get sick. I can still die. There's nothing that I can do to protect myself. There's nowhere that I can go to protect myself. And that's why these viruses are so great for these kind of sensational narratives, because they really tap into that amount of fear, you know, that you there's no way to protect yourself, supposedly, even though, of course, there is, right? But you had the case in 2014 of the doctor in New York that had Ebola, and he'd gone bowling. And they closed down the bowling alley for a week, and people were saying, oh, my God, I'm never taking the subway again, because he rode the subway. And it's like, okay, settle down. It's not that easy to catch Ebola. But, again, there's this notion of, like, I can't protect myself. I'm vulnerable. And so people are going to go to those movies. They're going to read the articles. And so it's very easy to sensationalize.
Right, because we've seen, you know, somebody sneeze in a Dustin Hoffman movie, and 5 minutes later, half the population of the earth is dead. We know exactly the truth. You're just trying. You're working for the subversion side of this. You just want us to believe it's not a problem. Let's take a break. We'll come back and continue talking when we can, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Dahlia Schweitzer is our guest, and I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the fact that The Evil Dead, there's another zombie movie with the Deadites, and Robert writes in and says, most frightening zombie movie for me, the viciousness of the zombies and the scene where they're breaching the wall in Jerusalem still haunts me today from World War Z. As you mentioned in the last segment, that is a creepy aspect. That was a totally different kind of hive collective worker ant environment, the way they kind of climbed on each other and spilled over. That did make it a lot more terrifying, didn't it?
Yeah. No, because you're powerless. I mean, one zombie you can probably get away from, but when there's thousands of zombies,
right,
it's like there's nowhere to hide.
Why do you feel that they choose to play on our fear so much? I mean, is it part of the conspiratorial angle that Big Pharma's behind it, and that way they get us onto the medications that are easier to control us and make money with?
Why does the media, the
people behind these stories and propagating them, do you think that it has anything to do with these conspiratorial angles of Big Pharma and, you know, just kind of pushing a silent agenda?
I definitely feel like there's more than meets the eye. And I also definitely feel like the Centers for Disease Control have their own specific agendas, and we do not have all the facts. That, I think, is a very safe assessment to make. I think there's one. I actually wrote an article. I don't know how many people know this, but there's an organization called Hollywood Health and Society, which is basically a liaison between the Centers for Disease Control and Hollywood. And they serve many different functions. So, for instance, if you're working on a TV show and a character is going to get sick, and you want to make sure that you're doing it accurately, you contact Hollywood Health and Society, and then they connect you with someone at the CDC who can then serve as the consultant, right? So that's a very, you know, Hollywood loves their consultants. But what else is interesting is the CDC will go to Hollywood Health and Society, and they'll say, we really want to push these issues. And then Hollywood Health and Society will then push those issues. How do they push those issues? Well, they might organize a panel with a bunch of guest speakers, and then they'll invite, you know, a bunch of Hollywood directors and writers. Or the consultants might say, this is really how you want to present the issue, right? Or like, we have this new PrEP drug that's supposed to reduce your ability to catch HIV, right? So we want to push that drug, and so then there ends up being a really interesting kind of plot line in How to Get Away with Murder, where the characters have to learn about this drug and they go to get tested, and it's all very clearly spelled out. And so the CDC actually, even they're not like paying money. It's not like they're going over, you know, to a TV show and saying, you know, here's $5,000, add this into your script. But there is a lot of behind the scenes stuff that I think people aren't necessarily aware of.
All right. And the idea that they're playing on these fears as well, I've often wondered if these are ways to see how we're going to respond to these possible issues in the future. You know, is it some of it being trolled out as a controlling factor? Because again, the best way we've learned through history to control people is through fear.
Right. Yes. And I mean, at the Republican National Convention, it was like every other person was talking about how, you know, there's so much fear and the murder rate is higher than it's ever been and all this stuff, which actually isn't true, right? We're safer than we've ever been. We're just more aware of risk than we've ever been. And the 24-hour kind of media cycle not only allows the information to spread, but it creates this demand where you constantly have to be coming up with new news stories, right? It's not like, oh, we just have to fill the evening news. It's like, oh, we have to, you know, constantly be sending out information to get people paying attention, clicking on our site, reading our articles, whatever. And so, yeah, of course, you make people afraid. And it's interesting because rulers in like ancient times used to dream of an outbreak, right? An outbreak would be like their wish come true, because when people are afraid, they're going to do whatever you tell them, right? So you tell them, hey, there's a curfew. You can't leave your house after 7 p.m. because there's, you know, monsters in the streets or viruses or whatever, people are going to stay home. You know, you tell people there's a risk of terrorism, so we need to be able to arrest anybody we want to at any time and look through their phones and whatever, because we're looking for terrorists. And people are going to say, okay, sure, whatever you need to do. So fear is incredibly useful for keeping people, you know, under control.
What are the differences in the way we tell outbreak stories today as opposed to, you know, the way we would have covered them 40 years ago?
Well, what's interesting in my book is that you didn't really have outbreak narratives before the 1990s. You had narratives like there was the movie The Andromeda Strain in 1971, where there is a viral outbreak, but it's very localized, right? It's just in the town of Piedmont, and then they figure out that it's on this piece of, this rock that came from outer space, and they've got it in the lab, which is very much underground. And so it's all very, very localized. So it was really in the mid-1990s where you started to get movies like Outbreak. There was a TV movie called Formula for Death. You start to get this notion of like the virus traveling, right? So the virus is in Africa, in a monkey or whatever, and then it travels to the U.S. where it infects the innocent white people, and then we have to save the day, Dustin Hoffman comes in, et cetera. So that kind of narrative really only kicked off in the mid-1990s. But even then, when it first started, it was very localized, right? So you could really trace the path of the virus. You know, you were going from point A to point B, you could see where it was happening. And then in marked contrast, in 2011, you have Steven Soderbergh's Contagion, where within the first 5 minutes of the film, the virus is all over the world. I mean, everything travels so much faster, transportation is so much faster, that you no longer have this clear trajectory of like, oh, here the virus is going from point A to point B. It's like the virus may have started at point A, but suddenly it's everywhere, right? It's all over the world. And that's where I think World War Z is also really interesting, because we start to get the world being, you know, the kind of being global in scope. So I think that's one of a really pronounced change. But I think another thing that's interesting is after 9/11, you started to get a lot of bioterrorism. So you'd had bioterrorism before 9/11, but after 9/11, it became really prevalent. And I think it's also interesting to trace where the threat of the virus is coming from. And so in 1995, the spread of the virus came from Africa, right? And you have this notion of sort of primitive Africa. And if you didn't know any better, if all you saw was movies like Outbreak, you'd assume that Africa was medicine men beating on drums and people living in huts, right? And then after 9/11, you start to get the idea of the terrorist who is spreading the virus intentionally. And that terrorist could be, you know, Al-Qaeda, right? You have the TV miniseries, Hades One, the Hades Factor, A Covert One, where you have Al-Qaeda terrorists who smuggled the virus into the U.S. by injecting it into themselves. So they become almost like suicide bombers because they're infectious. And so then that kind of becomes another wave that happened after 9/11. And then, of course, now you have the post-apocalyptic narrative where the viral outbreak has already happened, right? Like in The Walking Dead, I Am Legend, and all those. And so we're sort of fascinated with, we fast-forwarded ahead to let's see what happens after the outbreak.
Well, and isn't it interesting, too? You just mentioned I Am Legend, and I have a lot of people emailing me about that, saying that that is, you know, another zombie or vampire-like outbreak. But when you look at the transition, I mean, that story was written in 1954, so right after the Korean conflict or during the Korean conflict, right after World War II. So here you've got this kind of interesting story about a biological possibility. I Am Legend. Then, of course, the movie, the first iteration of it, was The Last Man on Earth in 1964, which starred Vincent Price. So that's right in the heat of the Vietnam War. Then you've got I Am Legend starring Will Smith, which is released in 2007 during the Afghanistan and Iraq crisis. So it seems like this is always kind of prevalent right around war times. The idea of this kind of propagating that you know, this may be our next glimpse of the future. This may be how things evolve for us. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We've got more, and we'll take some of your calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Dave Schrader, hey, that's me. Thank you for tuning in and being a part of our world tonight. Dahlia Schweitzer is my guest. Her book, Going Viral, Zombies, Viruses, and the End of the World. She takes a look at everything from I Am Legend to The X-Files to World War Z. The book examines how outbreak narratives both excite and horrify us, conjuring our nightmares while letting us indulge in fantasies about fighting infected others. Going Viral raises provocative questions about the cost of public paranoia and the power brokers who profit from it. You can check out the book. It's out and available right now. We've got a lot of calls lining up. We'll take your calls, and if you want to shoot me some more emails, I'll try to weave them through the last part of the show. You can hit me up at dave@darknessradio.com. That's dave@darknessradio.com. And remember, if you want the best in paranormal talk radio, check out my show at darknessradio.com. You can listen to it, stream it, and find it right there. And if you are a Droid user, go to the Google Play Store and get our free Darkness Radio app and never miss another minute of our show. We'll be back. We've got more. We've got your phone calls right after this on Coast to Coast AM. All right, Dolly, are you ready to start facing the Coast to Coast listeners, their questions and stories?
Sure, bring it on.
All right, east of the Rockies, Joe in Long Island, New York. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, I have a comment and a question about a specific movie. My comment is like that it seems like some of these movies, it's like kids going to an island and they dabble in something and it backfires on them. You know, that seems to be like they got more than they bargained for. And then they're facing zombies or something like that. But I want to ask about a movie, Parts Per Billion, if you guys saw that on Netflix. It was about a chemical cloud coming from, a war in the Middle East or something like that, that was coming over to a place like Detroit that looked like it was set in, or someplace like St. Paul, Minnesota. And like the characters, instead of panicking, were really trying to ignore it at different levels. And one guy's shooting baskets and the foghorn is going off and he's mad that it affected his jump shot, as an example. And that, you know, so it was like...
I'm not familiar with that.
I've never watched that movie either.
Yeah, it's called Parts Per Billion. I thought it was fantastic as a doomsday movie.
I'll have to look for that.
All right. Thank you very much for listening and giving us a call. Let's go to west of the Rockies, Dennis in East Lake, Ohio. What did you want to share with us tonight?
Thank you for having me on the show. First off, I just wanted to say that The Walking Dead is my all-time favorite show. And I've been watching it since day one.
Sure.
And I must have seen it at least four times.
Why is it your favorite show?
Why is it? I really can't explain why it's my favorite show. I mean, you guys were asking earlier, you know, what makes me so, interested in the show. And I have to say that, I like to put myself in their shoes and I like to imagine, you know, what I would do in their situation. And, I also wanted to say, if you guys have seen Fear the Walking Dead, I recently saw a trailer for the show because it's returning soon, and Morgan from The Walking Dead, and they showed him in Fear the Walking Dead, so it seems like they're going to connect those two shows.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I think that's kind of been the big move they talked about earlier this year. Lemmy is going to go over to the Fear the Walking Dead, which might bridge what happened in between the time Rick had seen him, you know, after the outbreak initially happened, and when they hook up again.
That would be exciting.
I'm very excited for the I haven't really watched Fear the Walking Dead because I didn't find it as good as the Walking Dead, but
it's horrible.
Red Machete's coming out.
Right. Well, isn't Red Machete just like the online kind of threaded story?
Yeah, I'm not too sure, but they haven't showed anything about it. I mean, the trailers, I mean, there hasn't, you know, really.
That's because they want you to go to the website. I think it's to draw attention to the web content that they have. I think the entire little series is over on is on the actual website for AMC. So you might want to go check that out. You might want to go check it out on AMC. I think that's just an online web series.
Oh, really? So it won't be on TV?
No, I think that's just kind of giving you... A lot of these different shows will do these little webisodes.
It's a digital series.
Right. It's just a digital series, and I think it's telling you where Rick got that the machete from and how its journey made it to Rick's hands.
Exactly.
Or how, right. So that's what you're looking at. Thanks for calling in, Dennis. Am I the only one who's still irritated by the fact that somebody's manicuring the lawns during the zombie outbreak and there are still fat people? And I, speaking as a fat person, how are there still fat people 8 years into the zombie apocalypse?
I think that's an excellent question. And Zombieland actually has that joke where it talks about how, you know, like if you're fat, you're going to die because the zombie's going to get you. And there's that scene where they're running across the football field and they're being chased by the zombie.
Right.
So that's one of the things that I like about that movie, is it sort of calls attention to that. But I agree with you totally. You think people would all be looking sort of gaunt by now.
Right. Yeah, everybody should be in a lot worse condition. I don't know about you. I mean, if I don't have a sandwich, you know, between noon and 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I just need a nap. These guys are running around chopping heads off and going to war. It's totally unbelievable.
Yeah, I get cranky.
The other thing that drives me crazy about this is, if the disease is already in people, right, and they're bleeding in our eyes and in our mouths, they're, you know, getting their spit all over our cuts, and that doesn't turn us, but it takes a bite. Yet half of their jaws are hanging off and they bump into something and their skin falls off, their bottom jaw falls off, but yet they can. Have you ever tried? Just put your hands on your stomach right now and try to tear your own stomach apart. Do it. Do it, Dahlia. Do it.
I'm doing it. I'm doing it right now.
You can't. You can't. How the hell are zombies tearing through stomachs when we can't do it fully and part of ourselves? I don't get it.
That's actually a really good point, because their fingernails, I mean, unless you have like the really dagger long fingernails,
right. Yeah.
How do you do that?
And where's the power in the jaws? They're all just, I don't, you know, that's the part of the whole zombie narrative that falls apart for me. Where I used to be more terrified, I had, believe it or not, the logic of a stoner friend walk me through why I should never be afraid of zombies.
And how old were you when that happened?
38. So don't judge. First time caller, James, in Vancouver, Canada. Welcome to the show.
Hi. So I just want to talk on that subject real fast about what you were mentioning, like clawing your own stomachs and why they have that jaws bit.
Right.
Did you guys ever heard the series that was on, I forget what channel was it, but it was pretty much The Deadliest Warriors?
No, I'm not familiar with that.
The Deadliest Warriors?
Yeah, it's not off subject, but it was all about bringing, like, who would win, ninjas, Spartacus, all that kind of stuff. The last episode talked on, like, zombies versus vampires. I kind of laughed at that. And they were going on the idea of their claws, mandibles, and all that kind of stuff. And I'm part of a zombie group, Resident Evil kind of group. Fun fact on that one. We do charities at times. But we discussed that idea as well, because people were going, why would you want to, like, what would you use to protect yourself if there were real zombies? We're like, well, maybe a taser. And someone goes, why a taser? And then we discussed the breakdown of a zombie from what we've seen from TV, movies, video games. It's all about the brain, right? The nervous system, the spine. Good shock in that body brings them down. So then we discussed the idea of, like, motor functions, bone structures. We just literally broke the whole thing down of that zombies are a scary thing, because you cannot understand what they're going to do. Plus, they're silent creatures. They're silent and deadly in a sense. They're pack herders kind of things. And I mentioned when being asked about being a first-time caller, like, about subjects. Have you guys ever heard of also the zombie ant?
No.
Yeah, there are zombie ants. And I think, Tim, my producer Tim here, wasn't there the story, too, about the bees or the wasps that were being affected by this fungus that were making them kind of a – right, yeah, they were being taken over, the both ants and wasps were being taken over by some kind of fungus that would make them, in essence, kind of a zombie creature.
That's fascinating.
Well,
in the article,
that's what you said.
National Geographic, apparently the fungus will make them like literally brain dead, and kind of this whole entire structure of where they based off instincts. And so that's where they kind of got it. And CDC apparently has a website as a joke for that zombie kind of thing because of it.
Right.
from what I was told by somebody. And I was like, wow, CDC is actually making a zombie outbreak warning situation. Max Brooks, Mel Brooks' son, made a zombie survival guide about that same time, I believe, and it was a bestseller. And he's afraid of zombies. It's one of his biggest fears.
Sure.
And I was terrified of zombies back when I saw Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, and all those movies. But when I started playing the video game Resident Evil, I started seeing what the horror was, because in the original game, it's all about zombies confined in a house, in a mansion, and you're stuck in there trying to find out why. And you discover their viruses. And when you were talking about those pharmaceuticals, the main villains, technically the corporation Umbrella, were basically creating a bioweapon for super soldiers. Again, I don't understand what the common trait of that is, but with the whole concept of creating a virus, they created multiple different types, going all the way through like a genetic mutation, bringing back the dead, all the way even close to creating other similar viruses from the dawn of time, such as something called Las Plagas. And the creators of this series of Resident Evil, Shinji Mikami, based the idea off of Day of the Dead and Night of the Living Dead. Fun fact also, when they were thinking about making the very first Resident Evil movie, the live action, Romero was pitching the idea of also, if I'm correct, he pitched it, or they were pitching it to him, hey, why don't you make our Resident Evil movie? It was in like talks, and then unfortunately we got what we have now, and I'm not a big fan of that. If you do want a recommendation for a good movie from them for Resident Evil, look up the CG movies, Resident Evil Damnation. I believe the other one is Vendetta and Degeneration. Those are based off the All video right. game, and show you kind of an insight of how other countries use the concept of viral outbreaks and the corporations that use this. Because in my book, I believe that corporations in that game showed us maybe we shouldn't rely on them, because right. why would they give us such things?
Well, thank you, James. I think that's the whole idea, right? The folly of man. We think that we're setting it up to create a super soldier, and where we think we're about to make life better
right.
is the breakdown. It's the monkey paw, right? We make this wish, and things go horribly wrong on the other side.
Always.
Right, and that's kind of the narrative we see in a lot of these movies and character reels. I will tell you something. I know you and I talked on the Tom Bernard Show, and I don't know if you ever did your research on this when I brought it up to you, but I thought this was interesting. My co-host Tim and I from Darkness Radio always have this battle of what's going to take us first, the rise of the Terminators, which, according to Stephen Hawking's post 2 weeks ago, he thinks AI is going to be the thing to wipe us out, and we need to get off this planet quick. You know, and of course you've got the Alexas laughing at us and doing weird things on their own, and you know, robot consciousnesses that they put together on Twitter that started acting very weird and threatening, and you've got all that. So that's one aspect of it. And then I joke around about, no, I think it's going to be the zombie outbreak. And you know what? There was something very interesting that happened starting in, I think it was around 2012. And if you don't believe me, folks, go look this up. People started eating each other. And it was due to the bath salts use. No, that's not the stuff you sprinkle in your bathtub to make your skin soft and supple. It's a drug called bath salts, and it's a cheap, inexpensive, I think, like version of a meth, or crack cocaine. But people are smoking it, and they were attacking. People found guys hunched over, homeless people eating their faces. A woman had smoked it and ended up eating the child that was in her care. There was all of this weird case. And now the drug hasn't gone away. People are still using bath salts. But where did the stories go regarding the attacks? Because you would think it wouldn't just be part and parcel to just one branch of the bath salts. I often wondered, was there something that did happen? Was there some kind of outbreak that occurred? And then they just conveniently swept it under the carpet of a drug issue, because I haven't seen many stories, and even doing some research today, it was around 2012 to 2015. And that's about it. You just stop seeing stories about people eating each other, but we know bath salts are still out there.
Right.
What do you make of something like that? That's weird.
it's very weird. And I did look it up after we talked about it, and it is weird that it would be so isolated.
Right.
You know, and it was only isolated. It was like in just a couple different cities and things like that. And so I think it is very weird, like, because if it was even more isolated, then you'd think like, oh, maybe it was just like this particular, you know, this particular drug. It was maybe a mix of a couple different things, whatever. But it was in a few different cities, which makes it seem like you can't just blame it on like, you know, one bad drug. So I love the X-Files. You know, right. And I think the important takeaway from that is the notion that we're not being told the whole story on anything, right? And we don't know what the ulterior motives are. You know, is it just because they don't want us to panic, or is it because they're trying to get us to do A instead of B? I don't know, but I feel like the information that we're getting through the media is never telling us the full story.
I completely agree, and I think that's just a weird aspect of the whole story. Now, I will tell you one thing that was very frightening. After you and I talked on the Tom Bernard Show, I got an email from two different chemists in the United States who said that they heard the show. They said, here's something you should know. These synthetic drugs, including synthetic marijuana that's going around, they actually have an effect on the brain that is causing people to break down basically to a basal animal element. And
wow.
That as we see more and more people use this drug and abuse it, that it is going to reduce their brains to this very base animal instinct, and they think there's going to be more attacks. So if it comes, it may just be coming on the heels of these designer, generic, knockoff brand versions of drugs, street drugs is what I'm talking about, not your, generic versions of medicinal prescribed drugs. But I thought that was interesting. Two different chemists, two different parts of the United States, both writing in with a similar deal and saying that they're seeing really unusual cases where it comes to that. We'll see where this takes us. It's a great book. A lot of fun to read. Really makes you sit back and think about it, Dahlia. And I thank you for joining us on the show this evening to share this.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a pleasure. Going Viral, Zombies, Viruses, and the End of the World. It's out and available. Dahlia Schweitzer, I want to thank Donna and Nathan back at home base here for running the show. Nathan, great musical selections for us this evening. My producer and engineer here at KNSI Radio in St. Cloud, Tim Dennis, my producer Chris Boros, Lisa Lyon, and of course, the master himself, George Norrie, and George Knapp for allowing me to sit in for him this evening. And I want to thank our guests, Sarah Whalen and Dahlia Schweitzer. I'll be back with you April 20th and 21st behind the helm. Until then, check out my website, darknessradio.com. Be kind, be nice, love one another, and just do good. That's all I can ask. Until I'm here again with you, I'll talk to you again on Coast to Coast AM.